and thank you for joining us on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. A WTTW News exclusive. A letter from Chicago's Police Misconduct Agency notes troubling traffic stops on the west side months before Dexter Reed's fatal shooting. Meanwhile, the United Nations says Chicago needs to do more to remedy what it calls racialized police violence. Exploring the lasting impact Dr. King's assassination had on Chicago's west side. And the grand opening of a South Suburban brew pub that serves as a tribute to the founder's late son. And now to some of today's top stories. Advocates had their say at a city council meeting or a committee hearing about missing and murdered black and brown women in Chicago.
The reality of gender-based violence is deeply intertwined with the issue of missing women and girls. Many of the young women who have become missing are at high risk due to exposure from various forms of violence, including intimate partner violence, relationship abuse, and other forms of gender-based violence. We cannot effectively address this issue without recognizing and acting on those root causes.
The Council's Committee on Public Safety heard from advocates, journalists, and family members of missing or murdered black women in the city. The hearing was intended to identify obstacles to resolving cases and explore new strategies to prevent more women and girls from going missing in the city. The Chicago Teachers Union is detailing its ideas to fully fund public schools, including its contract, which is still under negotiation. CTU today released its five-year plan, which it says outlines ways to create over $1 billion in revenue through TIF expirations, loan refinancing, closing corporate tax loopholes, and more.
The cost of our contract is the cost of running public schools in the city of Chicago. That's the cost of our contract. The cost of our contract is the cost of having schools that are funded, that are resourced, that have sports in the fall season, the winter season, the spring season, that provide students with recess and healthy meals.
The union says its report aligns closely with the district's recently released plan, or five-year plan, Together We Rise. But despite that alignment, CTU says its contract is still incomplete, and it's filed for mediation and fact-finding as part of the bargaining process. Chicago soccer fans will have to get used to a new name for the women's team. The Chicago Red Stars are now the Chicago Stars Football Club. The team rolled out the new name and new look today. The team's crest includes a soccer ball and the Chicago six-pointed star, which it says is intended to represent the team's civic pride and also the Stars' athletes on the field. Up next, a troubling pattern of CPD traffic stops months before Dexter Reed's death. Heather Sharone with this WTTW News exclusive right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
The agency responsible for investigating misconduct by Chicago police officers identified a troubling pattern of undocumented and aggressive traffic stops on the west side at least a year before officers killed Dexter Reed. That's according to a letter obtained exclusively by our own Heather Sharone, who joins us now with details. Heather, first, remind us what happened to Dexter Reed on March 21st.
Four officers fired 96 shots in 41 seconds shortly after stopping Dexter Reed. In a traffic stop, officers told investigators was prompted on suspicion he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Now, those four officers remain on administrative leave and have not returned to active duty, but have not been stripped of their police powers, as the Civilian Office of Police Accountability recommended, as they continue to investigate this shooting death.
Okay, so what does the letter that you obtained then tell us about his death?
That letter from the Director of Investigations for COPA shows that COPA had documented a troubling pattern of traffic stops and pedestrian stops in the same police district where Reed was killed. Those stops were not documented, according to this letter, in accordance with departmental policy, nor were they recorded by officers' body-worn cameras. That made it impossible for COPA, the Director of Investigations said, to determine whether these stops had probable cause, and raises the possibility that this pattern existed for many months before Dexter Reed was killed, but nobody in the city took any action to say, hey, we've got a problem.
So to that point, why didn't the city's misconduct agency alert Police Superintendent Larry Snelling and his staff about this pattern sooner?
COPA Chief Administrator Andrea Kirsten said they were working diligently behind the scenes to document this pattern and marshal enough evidence to present it to the police superintendent, but simply hadn't completed that work by the time Dexter Reed was killed, prompting them to send the letter 6 days later after his death, realizing that this had become an issue of critical importance to the city, as Mayor Brandon Johnson called for calm.
Okay, so how has, or has CPD, you know, changed the way they stop people on the West Side?
Well, police spokespeople declined to answer my questions in detail about these stops or Dexter Reed's killing, which remains under investigation. However, they did say that after Reed's killing, officers were reminded about departmental policy and that they had to not only file the proper reports, but record those interactions on their body-worn cameras. Whether that has made any difference on the West Side in Garfield Park and Humboldt Park, we just don't know.
All right. Exclusive reporting from Heather Sharon. Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. In 1966, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to Chicago's West Side to protest against discriminatory housing practices. The neighborhood went into an uproar following his assassination, resulting in numerous riots and looting. A new Chicago Stories documentary called When the West Side Burned outlines the destruction.
April 1968. Chicago's West Side bursts into flames after the news of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination.
Has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
The one man who brought hope for a better life was dead.
People who had pent-up frustration were letting it out.
I do remember one guy standing out and, "Burn, baby, burn."
Here to talk more about that time are two former West Side residents featured in the film, Benny Lee, founder and CEO of National Alliance for the Empowerment of the Formerly Incarcerated, and John Preston, community representative for the West Side Justice Center. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to ask you both, first, you know, this happened some time ago, but why do you think it is important to remember this history? Benny Lee, let's start with you, please.
Well, one, you look at what the prelude, what happened before the riot, what caused it. You know, we got some leaders today that's doing a lot of good work for us in our communities. Will this happen again if something happened to them? We should learn from that, what happened back then, how it had an impact on our community, and not resort to those measures if something like that happened again.
John Preston, why do you think it's important to remember this?
Well, I mean, there's certain things that we should never forget. As a people and America as a whole, so as not to repeat the same mistakes over again. And we do know when our leaders step out for good things that their lives are in danger. So we have to remember that, and we have to remember that we have as a community have to somewhat circle the wagons, you know, to protect our leaders from this.
Benny Lee, Dr. King chose to live in North Lawndale when he moved to Chicago. Why that neighborhood? What was significant about it?
I'm not sure his reasons for coming there. But when he came there, he came here with his Poor People's Campaign. And at that time, you know, it was like that birth of the Black Power movement. He was part of the Civil Rights Movement, but you had young radicals moving for the Black Power movement. And on the West Side at that time, where he stayed on 16th and Hamlin, you had the Viceroys, and they had a program called Tenants' Rights Action Group where they were challenging a landlord that was illegally evicting people out their houses. They was shutting down construction throughout the city because they weren't hiring Black contractors. I don't know his reasons for moving there, but that was what was happening in that area where he lived at.
So that ended up being sort of a natural relationship,
right?
Because the Viceroys and Dr. King ended up communicating. What was that relationship like?
Well, again, they marched with him because you got to keep in mind black ministers wouldn't allow Martin Luther King to even speak at their churches during that time because they didn't want him here. So it was not only just the Viceroy, but you had LSD, Viceroy, Stones, and Disciples. They became a citywide coalition, shutting down construction sites throughout the city. And so Martin Luther King, he benefited from them guys marching through Cicero with him when he went out south through Marquette Park. It was the Blackstone Rangers and the Disciples that marched with him out there. So that was his following right there to help him to do what he needed to do at that time.
John, at the time of his assassination, you were completing your paper route. How do you remember the community's response when the news first broke?
The community was a combination of shock and grief, and a bit of bewilderment as well. You know, to know that one of the biggest leaders that we have known as a race of people was gone. So it was a big blow, you know, so to speak.
How did you feel? How do you remember feeling when you were a young person, when riots broke out, the neighborhood begins to burn?
Well, I felt a great loss that we had lost a very, very great leader. And what direction would we go as a people? And what would we do? So I felt lost because there were a lot of things that Dr. King stood for. So I was sad on one hand and angry on the other hand on what should we do, you know.
You continued to do your paper route the next day. What stood out to you in the paper the next day?
Well, what stood out there is just the uproar in the community, the looting, the burning, and people just going out and just expressing their anger and by way of looting in the community. And of course, there were a lot of areas that were just cordoned off or, you know, confined just to the black community. So that's where a lot of the looting and rioting was contained.
Benny, you were a teenager at the time. What do you remember feeling?
Well, at that time, even before this had happened, we were dealing with a lot of racial attack on us as young youth, black youth graduating out of eighth grade and had to go through an all-white community or all-white high school just to get there. So when the looting happened, the older Viceroys, which we were the younger Viceroys, they was putting literature out, letting the community know, do not riot. So being a Viceroy, we was following the words of our leaders. Right, but on the other hand, we was thinking, well, these white folks done assassinated Martin Luther King. These white store owners deserve that. This is our way of retaliation. So I was a little ambivalent at that time at a young age.
How do you think these riots are different or the same from what we saw the summer of 2020?
Well, the difference now is that you have a lot of foreigners in our community. Like, for a good example, that the rioting spilled over in a little village with our young black brothers, right? And them little Latin kings over there said, hold on, wait a minute. Y'all take that somewhere else, because see, these were their fathers and grandfathers' businesses. Well, in the black community, these wasn't their fathers and grandfathers' businesses. These was foreigners' businesses. So there was a conflict even with the Hispanics and the blacks during that time.
John, we've got just a limited amount of time left, but what would you say has been the long-lasting impact of the riots on the West Side?
In a negative way or a positive way?
Yes.
I mean, so it's basically two sides to it. So in a negative way, we, in a sense, haven't fully recovered from those riots. And prior to that, and we had to understand, prior to Dr. King's assassination, there were other riots. Two in Chicago, 16th Street, parts of Roosevelt Road, you know. But that impact there, to know that, all of those type of things still exist. And the positive thing is that we are still trying to rebuild. We're still running into a lot of obstacles in that rebuilding process.
It sounds like the work remains. A lot of folks, of course,
right.
talk about some of those businesses
exactly.
having never fully recovered. We'll have to leave it there. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Benny Lee and John Preston, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can watch Chicago's stories, When the West Side Burned, here on WTTW Friday night at 8. And be sure to check out our website for more on the new Chicago Stories season. We're back with more right after this. The United Nations is calling out Chicago's history of, quote, racialized police violence, and says it needs to do more to remedy past wrongs. United Nations investigators say, quote, these heinous alleged human rights violations appear to significant extent to be rooted in systemic racism and have disproportionately affected people of African and Latin American descent. They went on to decry reports of arrest without cause and the use of torture to coerce confessions. Joining us now to tell us more are Mark Clements from the Chicago Torture Justice Center. Clements is a survivor of police torture and spent 28 years behind bars before his conviction was overturned. And April Ward, mother of Mikhail Ward, who was convicted of killing 15-year-old Hadiyah Pendleton. His conviction was overturned by the Illinois Appellate Court and remanded back to the lower court last year. The appellate court said his confession, which his lawyers and family say was coerced, should not have been considered at trial. Now, we also invited the Chicago Police Department, the governor's office, and the Cook County State's Attorney to join us. We did not hear back from CPD or the governor's office, but the state's attorney's office sent us a statement saying the office had made, quote, groundbreaking strides in addressing the systemic racism found in our criminal justice system, including overturning nearly 250 wrongful convictions tied to police misconduct. Mark Clements, April Ward, thank you both for joining us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Clements, let's start with you, please, because we know the history of Chicago police misconduct. It goes back a very long way, as you know all too well. How did United Nations investigators come to be looking at this issue, and then how did you get involved?
Working with Chicago Torture Justice Center, I learned that a group who called themselves the Mamas was putting together documents about particular people cases. So I submitted several of those complaints, one being Duro Fair, Michelle Cofton, as well as Duel Thomas. Just praying and hoping that the system would take a look at their wrongful convictions and police torture. And let me tell you, yes, they did. However, as you have read this long list of officials that do not want to get involved, that has been the problem.
And you mentioned the group Mamas that both of you work with. I want to, you know, our audience to know, of course, that stands for what is on your T-shirt, Mamas Activating Movements for Abolition and Solidarity. Mark, what is it that the United Nations says needs to happen?
Well, I believe that these cases that are referred to the United Nations must be a start in which these officials, they must look deeper into these cases. Michelle Cofton, being 26 years of age, taken to a police station, having her hair grabbed and squeezed, and being spit upon, and being framed with a murder, and raised the claim of torture from the outset. The Illinois Torture Inquiry Relief Commission finding that, well, guess what? There is some cause to suggest that she is wrongfully convicted. We're going to refer it over to Kim Fox's office, to her conviction integrity unit, and till this day, no one from that office has contacted Michelle Cofton unless Michelle Cofton has contacted them.
April Ward, your son, Mikhail, was, as we mentioned, in 2018. He was convicted of the murder of Hadiyah Pendleton, but last year, the Illinois Appellate Court overturned it, saying that his alleged confession should not have been considered at trial. What has he told you and your family attorneys about how detectives obtained that confession?
He told me that the confession, they held him for like 18 hours. But they kept waking him up. They even when he was on the stairs, They told him, you better give us a confession, and they was hitting him upside his head. Also, the when he first got arrested, they used the AR-15 and hit him upside his head.
There are reports that he also repeatedly told officers that he didn't want to say anything.
Exactly.
Did he ask for an attorney?
He asked for, he said, I don't want to talk. I have nothing to say. And he, on the stairs, he did ask for an attorney. They just went past it and they just kept on talking to him.
So we know that he remains in custody while this case works its way through the court process again. Mm-hmm. What do you hope this United Nations impact does? What do you hope that it does achieve for your son by shining a light on this issue?
To get the ball rolling. To understand that the if the United Nations has said that they think that it's a problem, then you need to look into it. You know, he's in the Illinois Supreme Court right now. He had his opinion heard. They did the argument for the opinion, and they still from, I think it's 7 months. It's been 7 months since, and they still haven't made a decision. They still haven't decided. How long does it supposed to take? And that's the issue.
Well, so, Mark, you know, it's the United Nations. They don't have a lot of real enforcement power. And it sounds like, you know, you haven't heard much from any state or local officials in response to this. What are you hoping happens? What happens now? Because this report from the UN came out in June of this summer.
Yes. The entire system is corrupt. It needs to be held accountable. It needs to look at the fact of Michelle Coffin, I believe 54 years old now today. She deserves, at least, regardless if she is guilty or innocent of that crime, she deserves where that they look into her claim of torture. Michael McDermott, a Chicago police officer who has a long history of police torture.
Michael McDermott, who has been named in other cases of
including
police torture.
Daryl Fair's case. And, you know, this is a tragic. Here it is, Dual Thomas taken to a police station over here on the west side and kicked in his head by police detectives inside of the interrogation room. No, that is a crime. These police officers need to be held accountable. But before we can hold them accountable, let these men and women out of prison.
Okay, that is where we'll have to leave it. Obviously, a lot of work for the officials, the justice system, to work their way through. Hopefully, we would like to hear from them on this issue as well. We'll have to leave it there. My thanks to Mark Clements and April Ward.
Yes.
Thank you.
Back with more in just a moment, but first, a look at the weather. Something new is brewing in the South Suburbs. Homewood Brewing Company had its grand opening last week after 3 years in the making. It's been a healing journey for founder Carmela Wallace, whose son, Jared Higgins, the rapper also known as Juice WRLD, died of a drug overdose in 2019. Juice WRLD was known for his candid and introspective lyrics about his struggle with addiction and depression. His mother says the brew pub is a way to give back to the community while paying tribute to her son's memory.
I just wanted to find a way to give back to a community that was special to Jared and I. So I just got the idea and it just grew into this beautiful project and turned into something really special. And actually, in building this, it was a way for us to heal. You know, this project has been going on for so long, so the thought of serving and building something impactful in the community was just refreshing. He loved Homewood. When we were looking for a high school, we chose to move to Homewood because he wanted to go to Homewood Flossmoor High School. So he was very connected, and once he became famous, he still came back home to Homewood. We have a benefit beer in which 10% of net proceeds goes to my foundation, in which we pour out to help other people. We recently just gave a donation of $100,000 to various organizations for Mental Health Awareness Day to support programs that support mental health and substance dependency programs. Jiren touched so many people through his music, and his message was for people not to suffer in silence and be alone. So I felt like I needed to continue his message and help those who were struggling and just find a way for them to get the help that they need.
Homewood Brewing Company is located on Dixie Highway near 183rd Street. Wallace's organization, Live Free 999, supports programs addressing mental health and addiction, and you can find more information on our website. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Early voting is underway for November's election, so be sure to check out our WTTW News Voter Guide before you head to the polls. That's at WTTW.com/voterguide. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm committed to giving back to the community through law and philanthropy.